Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Curator's Choice. I'm your host, Ayla Anderson, and today we're going to be all the way down in Florida. We are speaking with Heather Stapleton at the Heritage Center and Indian River Citrus Museum in Vero Beach. So she's going to be telling us the amazing story of their Micro and Mighty Museum, what makes the citrus from Indian River District so special, where oranges came from to Florida, why they do so well in Florida, and some of the items that she's going to be talking to us about. One of them is an olive jar from the 1700s that likely held sour orange seeds as commanded by Queen Isabella from her Spanish explorers. So we have a really cool backstory on that. And she is also going to be telling us about her amazing gallery of citrus labels, which was quite the big deal when it came to citrus marketing. And she also talks to us about a really unique apology letter that probably wouldn't be found today, but they have it framed in the museum. So she's going to share with us all these amazing things citrus. And I did want to let you know you can always find pictures of the episodes at curatorschoicepodcast.com. And you can see fun stuff on Facebook and on Instagram. And I did launch my Patreon. So if you are interested in supporting this podcast and getting a little bit of additional content, then please go to patreon.com/curatorschoice. Check it out. And I hope that you enjoy today's episode. We're going to talk about this incredible Micro and Mighty Museum.
Yeah, I love my Micro and Mighty Museum.
I love that you call it a Micro and Mighty Museum. And like I was telling you earlier, I've told that to a few different people. And they're like, we're going to start calling our museum that.
Yay, hashtag so maybe, Micro and Mighty.
Yes, maybe we'll start a huge trend. Like, you've got your side, and then I'll just try to be like, hey, you know what you could do with this museum?
Yeah.
It'd be perfect.
It was funny because some people tried to interpret it as micro but mighty. I'm like, No. We are micro and mighty.
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah.
Both are great.
Yeah, I'm very proud of the Indian River Citrus Museum. We're very quirky. We are the one and only. You're not going to find another Indian River Citrus Museum in the world. And I just want to embrace that. And I'm not trying to be anything more than what we are, because I think we're just enough to be, you know, this is impressive. It celebrates a big part of Florida's cultural heritage. Mm-hmm. And a part, we didn't even get to chat about this, a part that we're losing, not just because of development, but because of agricultural diseases as well. We've lost, the height of citrus harvest in the state of Florida was 1976 to 1977. That year we harvested 250 million boxes of citrus.
Wow.
This year the forecast is only 51 million boxes of citrus.
Whoa, that's a huge difference.
Yeah, massive difference. In Orange County, Florida, and Orange County, California, there are no oranges anymore. Yeah.
Dang. Okay. Yeah. So yes, it's important that people learn about citrus.
It's really important that we, try to preserve what we can and celebrate what we can and encourage our guests to then go out to the local places and purchase Indian River citrus. Mm-hmm. You know, what good does it do for me to tout how special we are if it doesn't help translate into anything for the people that are actually producing that specialty?
Definitely.
Yeah.
So it's really cool whenever you first walk into the museum, right? Because when we walked up, we saw these adorable little potted plants. Yeah. And they looked like little teeny tiny lawns. And we came in and we brought it up to you and we were like, oh, those are really cute. And you took us out there, you cut us off some. Yeah. We're going to get to try some later.
I can't wait for you to taste them.
And then, so tell us about that. And I really want to really quickly talk about your amazing cupcakes.
Oh, okay. Yes. So those are calamondins. And it's funny that you referred to them as limes because they are also known as Philippine limes. And they're very tart and very flavorful. They really pack a punch. And their popularity predates that of key limes. I know when people think about Florida, they do think about key limes, mm-hmm. but this is what was planted between 1920s and 1950s. And there were all sorts of recipes that we've turned into key lime recipes, but it was originally calamondin pie. There was original calamondin cake.
So I had never even heard of calamondin before.
Right, so those of us born after 1950s probably will have never heard of them, right? Yes. But those of us who were born in the 1950s have really fun stories. And so everyone's grandparents had a calamondin tree growing in their yard, and they're very prodigious. And so, and they're super tart, as I said. So little kids would have competitions to see, could they put them in their mouths without making a pucker face, or fun stories about when the Dodgers were in spring break training here, kids throwing them at each other, watching the Dodgers spring break games.
Very nostalgic.
Very nostalgic. And so people have lots of fun stories associated with calamondins, unbeknownst to me. And the way I found out all of these stories, I just to help market the museum, I entered a cupcake competition. I am not a professional baker. And I made a dark chocolate cupcake with a calamondin buttercream frosting and candied calamondins on top. And especially the men, for some reason, when they heard that I was using calamondins, they started telling me all the stories that I just shared with you. And they started plunking their votes in my jar before they even had a chance to taste my cupcake.
They were so connected to the calamondin.
And we, you know, it's funny, I was saying, you know, songs mean different things to different people. Well, apparently cupcakes mean different things to different people. And so people loved these cupcakes, and luckily they also enjoyed the taste.
After they already voted, they're like,
yeah,
all
after
right.
They'd already voted. Well, they got like 5 votes. So they'd plunk in like 2 votes just because they liked the story. And then they'd taste it, and then they'd plunk their other 3 votes in. So it ends up I beat out the 4 professional bakers.
What,
who
what?
Were, yeah, and I even have a medal to prove my winnings.
And she even agreed to give me the calamondin cupcake recipe. So.
Yes, I will gladly email the recipe. Yeah, it's awesome. And the secret is not only the calamondins, but using really high quality dark chocolate as well.
Good to
dark
know.
Chocolate cocoa powder. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see how that goes. I'll try to make some. I'll try to give, I don't know how, but I'm going to get my hand on some calamondins in the middle of Maryland.
Right.
But okay, so you walk in after we got this amazing calamondin experience, and you began to tell us a little bit about Indian River, what's so important and special about this area, because, you know, you think about it, yeah, you can get oranges from Florida, or you can get them from California. It's not really a big deal, but apparently I am very wrong, and it is a very big deal.
You are wrong. It's a big deal.
Now I know.
Right. Now you've been schooled. So yes, the Indian River District is just one of 5 citrus districts in the state of Florida, but it is the only district whose name is protected by the Federal Trade Commission. The reason that level of protection exists is back in the 1920s, everyone wanted to be able to use the phrase Indian River on their citrus. And the local growers said, blah, 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 but you cannot be in Tampa, for example, which is totally on the other side of the state from us, and call yourselves Indian River. It's got to mean something. And so it was a bit of a compromise to establish the boundary lines of the district. But once that was done, that name became protected. There was a cease and desist issued, and no one else was allowed to use that name. And the reason everyone wanted to copy the name is, well, quite frankly, they could get more money if it said Indian River. And the reason people were willing to pay more for the name Indian River is because our fruit is scientifically proven to be the sweetest citrus in the whole wide world, as is measured by the BRIC system.
So not only can you guys say we're the best, you actually have scientific backing. It's not just one of those claims.
Yeah, people think I'm making a joke when I say we're the best in the world, the sweetest in the world, and then they always giggle. I'm like, no.
No, this is real.
Yes, so we have the science. So our fruit is just as juicy as the rest of Florida. So Florida as a state does distinguish itself by having very juicy citrus, 25% juicier than California, because we get this massive amount of rain, 54 inches of rain per year, just in this part of Florida. Actually, in the farther south you go, even a little bit more. But that means that our fruit has a very thin, easily breakable, easily tearable skin, which can be a problem if the citrus hits the ground and the skin cracks. That's a way pathogens can get into the fruit. But we have the thin skin because we're so juicy.
I do have a question about this.
Yeah.
So I know that sometimes whenever you're growing tomatoes, right, and it's so moist in the air, I never had this problem growing tomatoes in Nevada, but you freaking moved to Maryland, and you're growing these tomatoes, and they split because there's so much moisture.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming there has to be something about how thin and flexible the skin is on the oranges?
Well, it also, citrus is a very long growing fruit. So it will start blossoming in February and you might not even get a fruit until the next March.
Wow. Okay.
So it's slow growing compared to a tomato. A tomato, you're growing a tomato in not even a couple months. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, if you get a massive amount of rain for this thing, your tomato is going to swell up. But citrus, it takes a longer time for that to happen. And our soils don't hold excess water. We have sandy soils. All of Florida used to be the bottom of the ocean. And so it's just funny. You go out into the dirt of Florida and it is not really very dirt-like. It's more sand-like. In fact, our official state soil is Majorca sand, which is hilarious. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Because you don't have anything else.
We don't have a dang thing else. So we don't have, for the most part, I mean, you know, in the hammocks and things, yes, there is some organic matter. But for the most part, our soils are very well drained. So the soils are not going to hang on to the extra moisture. And so, and because it kind of averages out to about 1 inch of rain per week, that is exactly what citrus needs to thrive.
Perfect.
Now, the interesting thing is that even though citrus likes that 1 inch of rain per week, it does not like to have its feet wet. And that contributes to why we have the sweetest product in the whole world.
Okay, so you have, Florida in general has the juiciest in the world, but Indian River specifically has the sweetest in the world. Tell me more.
Okay, all right. So what allows the Indian River District to have the sweetest citrus in the world is just the fact that citrus here actually grows under somewhat stressful conditions. Loves rain, loves irrigation. It does not love to have its feet wet. It does not like wet roots. And in the Indian River District, we have an extremely high water table. And so what that means is as the roots try to, you know, penetrate the soil and go down and be a deep taproot, they actually hit that groundwater, maybe not even 3 feet down. And the roots sense that water and they can't just puncture through it. And instead of growing vertically and deep, they grow horizontally and very shallow. That's not how any tree would prefer to grow. That creates stressful growing conditions for our citrus. It means that each tree makes fewer oranges, fewer grapefruits, whatever the case may be. But it's the same amount of sugar being produced by the tree divided by fewer pieces of fruit. It means that each fruit ends up with more sugar.
And, you know, when you explain that, it makes so much sense, right? But I would never in a million years have thought about something like that. And I know, you know, I do know what happens a lot of times when you stress certain plants and things, but I would have never thought that that's what makes you have delicious citrus here.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also interesting when you drive to the center of the state, you can just go out State Road 60 and, you know, you leave the Indian River District, you enter the Central District, and their trees are so loaded down with citrus. You would think that a branch is going to break off the tree. There's so much citrus on the tree. That's just not the growth pattern that you're going to see here in the Indian River District.
And that's why it was such a big deal to get that federal mandate, right? Because everyone wants to say they have the Indian River, but they don't.
Right.
It's like you said, champagne.
It's like, right. It's just like champagne. Yeah. So it's a protected named district.
So you mentioned earlier the BRIC method?
BRIX. B-R-I-X. And I am pronouncing that right. BRIX.
Oh, there might be.
Well, like, you know, Grand Prix, for example, the I-X in French is pronounced like a long E.
Okay.
But it really is BRIX. B-R-I-X.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So what you would do is generally in the field, a fruit would be sliced, you know, taken down from the tree, sliced open, and you're going to get the specific gravity using a hydrometer. That's nothing super scientific, quite honestly. And once you have the specific gravity of that liquid, you can easily translate it with these lovely tables, maturity ratio tables, you can find out the BRIX. It's the same if you were, you know, an at-home brewer might want to know the BRIX of their cider or beer or whatever. It sounds maybe a little more scientific than it is, but it is the way to prove the sweetness level.
Oh, okay, so it's basically just a ratio of sweetness per the amount of liquid that's in there.
sweet to sour ratio.
Oh, mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
And for home brewers and things like that, that's what helps them figure out what's the alcohol percentage of this beverage.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So it's just another tool to kind of prove how amazing yellow citrus is.
Yeah. As if taste weren't enough, we can prove it to you. And actually for some markets that does become very important. So for example, in Japan, the scientific provability is very important to them. So if they're going to import and pay a pretty penny, a pretty yen for, sorry, I couldn't resist. That's if they're gonna pay, you know, top dollar for this product, they do want some assurances that the whole lot coming to them is going to be what they think they're buying. Mm-hmm. And so that testing, you know, before it leaves Florida becomes very important.
And what's really interesting about this is, you know, I think everyone thinks of Florida and you think of oranges. I mean, you guys have it on all of your license plates. It's all over the streets. It's decorated. Everything is the Florida orange.
Our state flower is even the orange blossom.
Which seems like cheating because they're not originally from Florida. This is all blasphemy.
It is. Yeah. So though citrus thrives in Florida, it is not even supposed to be here. Mm-hmm. It was brought here by the Spanish explorers. So Spanish explorers, European explorers in general, did understand very well that eating citrus on ships prevented scurvy. They didn't know why. Vitamin C wasn't discovered until the 1930s, Nobel Peace Prize winners, but they didn't know why. Who cares why? They just knew that it worked. Yeah. And so there was actually laws about citrus and travel. And so the Spanish explorers in particular, they could load up with fresh fruit when they left port. But what would happen after they'd been traveling the world, you know, exploring, making maps, trying to find treasure, perhaps only losing all of their treasure, but that's another micro and mighty museum. And so what would happen was time to go home. How are we going to ensure that these sailors are healthy to get home to bring the queen all of her jewels that she has stolen from all over the world? Well, the way we do that is making a law. Queen Isabella made a law that each Spanish sailor was required to arrive with 100 orange seeds that they would go and broadcast, just kind of sprinkle around, and those could just kind of grow in the wild while they went out and about doing their thing. For the most part, they didn't plant organized citrus groves. There was some in St. Augustine for sure, but for the most part, the majority of citrus that came to the New World was just willy-nilly sprinkled around.
What time period was this?
So this would have been late 1400s, early 1500s.
So they're just kind of tossing out these seeds, not mm-hmm. giving any parental care whatsoever.
No TLC.
Yeah. And then they kind of go around, do their thing. And then after about 5 years, they would have enough fruit on the trees that they could, or is that when they don't start producing until 5 years?
They can produce as young as three. And especially now that we understand so much more about micronutrients, and micro irrigation jets and things like that, we can make trees produce even earlier than 3 years. But we have some fantastic old photos of 5-year-old grapefruit trees, and you would never believe that harvest is coming from that tree. Remember, Florida rarely has a dormant season. I mean, it's pretty rare for us to even get into the 40s in this part of Florida.
That's true.
Stuff just keeps on growing all the time.
So then they would just kind of circle back to these areas, load up on the fresh fruit, and then take off, go back to Queen Isabella and give her a bunch of goods.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, and you said that it was a particular kind of orange.
Yes. So it was very important, and when visitors come to our museum, they can actually look at these seeds and they can notice that something is very different about the seeds that the Spanish brought with them. And that is, to me, these seeds look like someone split them right in half. One side is extremely flat and angular. That's indicative of sour oranges. The reason these explorers brought sour orange seeds, one, it's just what was more popular eaten at the time. They did not peel and eat fresh fruit the way we do now. And so they used it in marinades, they used it in beverages, they used it in perfumes and cleaning products. So they needed something that would really pack a punch. Sour citrus is way more flavorful than sweet citrus. It's just very tart, very, very sour. And so, but that's what was more popularly consumed. But probably more importantly than that, Sour oranges are a little bit more cold tolerant. Nobody knew what the weather was going to be like here. Mm-hmm. And probably the most important, sour orange trees are much more resistant to pests and diseases. So like I said, yeah, there were a few groves being planted in St. Augustine, but these guys needed something that would likely survive on its own.
Without any TLC.
Without any. And later, you know, actually they did change seeds to seedlings or saplings, and they were literally digging a small hole and shoving it in, but then not doing anything thereafter. No watering, no fertilizing, no weeding, you know, just kind of hoping that something would survive. And they did. It just so happened that citrus thrives in Florida. We have the perfect conditions for it, even though it's not from here.
Well, so it's thriving, and that's one of the cool things. Whenever you come into the museum, you can actually see them. You guys have in this container, one of the first things that you can see is the amazing, tiny, weird-looking orange seeds.
Yeah, they are weird.
That are, you know, cleaved in half. But you also have our first artifact, which is how you guys know that they were bringing them over, right?
Right. So not only is our area called the Indian River Citrus District, but this specific area is also known as the Treasure Coast because of so many treasure ships that have sunk off of our coast. In particular, the 1715 Plate Fleet wreck is right here off of the shores between Sebastian and Vero Beach, Florida. And there were 11 Spanish galleons and one French ship that were sailing. They had just left Cuba. They were on their way back to Europe.
Loaded down.
Loaded down with treasure, except for the French ship. The French ship was not loaded down and therefore got about a week or maybe even 2 weeks head start. And so the French ship made it home unscathed. The Spanish galleons all fell subject to an early season hurricane. You know, these explorers knew about the Gulf Stream. They knew about hurricanes, and so they weren't stupid. They were traveling at a time that they were taking advantage of the Gulf Stream, and they thought safe weather conditions. This was just an early season hurricane, and those ships all went down right off of our coast, and this awesome artifact is an item that was retrieved by famous treasure hunter Mel Fisher and his team from the 1715 Plate Fleet. This thing is called an olive jar.
And it may not have had olives.
It probably didn't.
That's very misleading.
Yeah, very misleading. Very misleading. Yeah, the kids that come in here are like, what? So this is dubbed an olive jar because of its shape rather than because of its contents. And so this olive jar might have contained a ship's worth. So you have 100 seeds, I have 100 seeds, he has 100, you know, all of us have to have 100 seeds. They would have been packed into a jar like this, likely with mosses to help keep them moist. The saltwater environment is very harsh on seeds, tended to dry them out over time. And so once we arrived to shore, then they would sprinkle them out in each person's hand, and then it was your responsibility to fling them out into the wild. As long as you were away from the beach itself, they will likely grow anywhere in Florida.
So what's cool about this jug here is it probably would have had these seeds in it on the journey for coming over, and then they probably would have loaded it with other things once they dumped out their seeds, maybe.
I never even thought about that. Yeah. I'm sure they had to have used it for something on
right?
the way back
because,
home.
Because, I mean, you already have this nice storage unit, then maybe it had some nice treasure pieces in it.
Yeah, who knows?
We may never know. But
we may never know.
And
yeah.
It's great now because you can tell that it spent a lot of time in the water because
yeah.
It actually has, like, you can see some coral that was growing on here.
So you've got some encrusting corals. You've got some oyster shells remnants. My favorite, though, are these encrusting worms. You can see these tube worms.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, ships would become quite laden down with these tube worms. And here's a little barnacle on this side. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty legit. It's authentic for sure.
That's amazing. And so this was recovered by Mel Fisher, who was a famous treasure seeker.
Yeah, treasure hunter Mel Fisher. Yes, he is most famous for really having discovered and recovered the Atocha, which is a wreck down in the Florida Keys. But Florida has all kinds of wrecks, and Mel Fisher and his family have probably played a role in helping, you know, retrieve most of them, quite honestly. Mel Fisher has since passed away, but his family carries on his legacy. And there is the Mel Fisher Treasure Museum in Sebastian, Florida, which is just, you know,
just right up the way.
Yeah, 6 miles north of where you are right now.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Cool. Well, we may have to go check that one out.
Yeah, there is another Micro and Mighty Museum as well called the McClarty Treasure Museum. And that museum is right on the ocean on the survivors' campsite. So there was fresh water there. And so the survivors, there were lots of deaths, obviously, but the survivors took shelter on that land because of the fresh water that was there. And that is where salvage, the original salvage activities were trying to take place. As you can imagine, they were desperate to get this treasure retrieved mm-hmm. before it came completely buried, you know, in sand.
But there's still a lot of treasure out there.
There is still a lot of treasure out there.
So if anybody is hankering to come do some treasure hunting, apparently it's a really big business right here.
It is. So there are lots of interesting, quirky laws about it. And the state always gets their cut, of course.
Absolutely.
But you are allowed, just as a private citizen, to have a metal detector on the beach itself. You run into a whole different story of complicated leasing structure, all these different leases of plots out in the ocean. And the Fisher family owns most of those plots. And so they now sublease those plots out.
Wow. So, okay.
Yeah, it's complicated.
Okay. So I probably will not be doing any of that this trip. Maybe next trip.
Yeah, right. Maybe next trip. But what is fun, you know, in the winter is when our seas tend to be a little rougher than in the summer. And so this is the time that you might find something on the beach itself. So now is not the time to go out in the water and try and find it because the water's starting to get cloudy with all the stirred up sand. Summer is the time to work your leases. Winter, especially after a big storm, a big nor'easter, winter is the time to look on the beach itself.
Okay, well, maybe I might change my mind. We'll see. We do have a metal detector, so.
Ooh, there you go.
So we have these Spanish the Spanish men coming down, bringing these sour oranges. Mm-hmm. But that's not really what is here now. There's not a lot of sour oranges that are sent from Indian River.
Right.
So what happened between then and now?
So probably it was a genetic mutation that created sweet oranges. Probably has existed almost as long as the original sour oranges. But they've always been more delicate to grow. They've always been finicky. They've always needed more TLC. And so what in the late 1700s, very early 1800s was happening when people were coming with the intent of pursuing agricultural interests in the state of Florida, they were able to make use of everything that had been left behind by the Spanish, which, by the way, was pigs, horses, cattle, sheep, and sour orange trees. Wow. And so folks were arriving here. It was like the land of plenty. I mean, not that it was easy, but you could go out into the wild and wrangle up what you wanted, what you needed. By the way, cowboys originated in Florida, not in Nevada and elsewhere. I know.
We're about to have some
mind
words.
Blown. Mind blown, right?
Man, my Nevada listeners are going to be mad.
Yeah, I know they're going to be mad. Should I give my email address or phone number?
I'll definitely send them your way.
Yes, so actually cowboys originated in Florida because those coming down here to pursue agricultural interests were going out and wrangling up from the wild the much later descendants of that original Andalusian stock that had been brought over by the Spanish.
What are Andalusian stock? Are they cows?
From Andalusia. So the horses and cows and sheep from Andalusia, Spain.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, were then, that's what the stock was because it was a hardier stock also. Mm-hmm. And then over the 300 years that they were left to their own devices, they became hardier yet again. And so that's, we call our horses marsh tackies. They became very adept at living in the swamps of Florida. The cracker cattle is what we call the descendants. They're much smaller. They're much more compact. Even the female cows have horns and they protect their young. You know, most modern breeds of horses, the babies have to be born in a barn and they have to be protected. These mamas were fierce and they were defending their young against Florida panther, even vultures, you know, all of these things. And so because the mothers were so protective and so caring of their young, that allowed that those new, you know, traits to carry on in what became known as cracker cattle.
Wow. Wow, I'm learning a lot today.
Yeah. And there is a fantastic book that we recommend that everybody read called A Land Remembered by Patrick Smith. It's historical fiction. It's amazingly accurate and entertaining, and you'd probably love it. Most people love it. I think it should be like required reading upon entering the state of Florida. Here's your A Land Remembered.
Here's your orange, and here's your buck.
Right. So as far as the traits and hardiness of these sour oranges go, those folk who were wrangling up animals, believe it or not, were also wrangling up the roots of the sour orange trees, digging those up, grafting onto that the sweet fruit that they surmised could become commercially successful, because that root was the hardy rootstock that had been living here in the progeny of, just like the cattle, just like the horses, it had adapted to local growing conditions. It was already hardier to begin with, mm-hmm. and now it, over 300 years, has further adapted to the local growing conditions. So these people, you know, knew that that's what they needed to give that sweet, delicate, or otherwise delicate fruit a chance. Yeah. And we still use that same grafting technique today. All modern citrus is grafted on different things, rough lemon, but it's all kind of the sour orange rootstock.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is interesting too. So I know that within different families of trees, that's what you can graft together, right?
Yeah.
So I remember this from seeing in a book somewhere. I think it was one of my high school books or something. And I was absolutely blown away by this concept, because it was some kind of tree, and it had five different kinds of fruits off of the same tree.
Yes.
And I was like, all right, that's what I want to do whenever I have a house.
Okay. So move to Florida, and you can do lemons, limes, calamondins, and grapefruit on the same tree.
All in the same tree.
Yes.
You just can. Have to graft them
you
on.
You can do that. Yeah, you just graft them on there. And actually, some of the big box stores, you can buy them pre-done for you. They call them cocktail trees.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This sounds amazing.
And grow it here in the Indian River District, and you know it'll be the sweetest.
That is true. That is true. I don't know. There's a lot of water down here for me.
There is a lot of water. Yeah. There's a lot of humidity. There's a lot of rain. There is a lot of water. And actually, the number of wetlands that we have in this area of Florida also play a protective role in the citrus, because they help to moderate our winter temperatures.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Just like Chesapeake Bay kind of does for where we are.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, obviously the Gulf Stream helps a lot. Vero Beach actually sticks out into the ocean 400 miles further east than Jacksonville.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's crazy. We think that Florida just kind of sticks down, but it actually juts out. And so, right, you know, the Gulf Stream obviously fluctuates, but we are about, in the summertime, we're about 20 to 24 miles away from the Gulf Stream in this part of Florida. And so in the winter, that increases a little bit, but still that moderating effect is still felt. So with the presence of the number of wetlands we have, our proximity to the Gulf Stream, we rarely get a hard freeze. Now, I'm not going to say never, mm-hmm. But rarely. Our last hard freeze was the winter of 2009, 2010. It actually got into the 20s multiple nights in a row.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you have this super hardy, this now hardy sweet orange, mm-hmm. because it has the hardy roots.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started, I guess, shipping them out?
So they start cultivating them, and everybody's got their 5 acres of citrus, you know, and because it does so well here, you know, it was supposedly like kind of like a lazy farmer's way of farming and making money, because that's how easy it was to grow here once they got the combinations figured out. And so what's happening now then is that the growers did not really have a shipping system in place. And so they were reusing old wine barrels, old wheat barrels, which are airtight.
Mm-hmm.
And they were being shipped literally by boat, which are slow. And so by the time these airtight vessels got anywhere, the contents were rotten. So this was not going to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily in the late 1800s, Henry Flagler puts in the Florida East Coast Railroad, and that really kind of seals the deal. And now not only do we have this ultimate product, we have a much faster, much more efficient way of shipping it out. And the shape of the train cars forced the shippers to get rid of the barrels and instead have cubes, boxes, you know, which obviously can stack much more efficiently than a barrel. Mm-hmm. And these crates, these shipping crates, were put together very quickly, very inexpensively, and as luck would have it, plenty of airflow.
Yeah, because they kind of have the slats in between. There's all these spaces, and it's relatively thin wood because you don't want it to be too heavy.
Exactly, and you don't want to waste a lot of resources. You know, that's not where you want your money going. Yeah.
So you have all these stackable, really cool boxes, but what you have a little display just around the corner.
Yeah.
Apparently, it was. I mean, we all know now how important having Indian River is on your citrus and how you can get more money for it. You know that it's better. But there must have been a lot of instances where people were getting their hands on these boxes and trying to say, oh, you know, this is the Indian River. So they came out with the design system on the sides.
Yes. So the labels are, so it's like if you and your neighbor were both producing Indian River grapefruit, how am I going to distinguish myself from my neighbor? And so that is when really this amazing art of marketing was born. And so these labels that were just glued to the ends of the wooden crates became very unique to those particular growers, or perhaps even unique to the market where they hoped that they might sell. And so when you think about it, citrus comes in season in winter. And winter in Florida is very mild. Winter up north is not.
No.
And so can you imagine you're at, you know, this auction warehouse. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. It's dark. It's cold. And in comes all of these boxes and you're just, you know, kind of over the northern winter. And you see a bikini clad beauty on the end of a crate. She is going to get your attention, especially because men do the purchasing at the auction sites. Women do the purchasing at the actual grocery stores, at the markets, but they were really marketing these big lots of citrus to men. And how effective in bright colors, and there's rainbows in some of them, and there's always a sun or a sunset or a sunrise. It's always beautiful.
Something
it's
warm.
Always, yeah, it's always tropical. Yes, it's always tropical. So what happened was not only did these amazing labels market the fruit inside the crates, they ended up marketing the Indian River area as a potential destination, maybe a tourist destination. Maybe you'll become a snowbird and come live down here during the winter. But you knew that you had to have some of that life, not just the stuff inside, but you wanted to be a part of that. Yeah.
This is really funny because it reminds me of a show I used to love when I was a little girl. I mean, let's be honest, I still love it now. But it's called Chicken Run. And it was one of those, like, the animated, the claymation
yeah,
ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in it, there are these chickens that would live on a farm. And they see, I can't remember, I think it might be a crate or something that has a picture of this beautiful green rolling hills and the sun, and it's gorgeous. And they're like, this is where we want to go. And I'm making this connection that that's exactly what these men were thinking, too, I'm sure. Because, you know, this was also probably before TV, probably
sure.
before those kinds of
yeah.
things. So you see a picture of something. And you're like, oh, I want to go there. That looks great.
Right. So the height of these labels was really about 1915 to just after World War II.
Okay.
So that was kind of their reign of these beautiful labels, very early marketing efforts. And they're really kind of chaste, most of them. You know, they're really mostly wholesome images. I mean, even the woman in the bikini is nothing like what a bikini is, you know, nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, and what's really fun is a local grower in our famous Michael family was able to get some of his shipping crates on the stage of a Broadway comedy in the 30s. I know, I love this story. So the comedy was called Lightning.
Okay.
And it was a comedy, and the critics didn't care for it, but audiences were going wild for it. And there were Mr. Michael's shipping crates up on the stage, and you know his labels were prominently placed.
So it's crazy, this product placement for oranges and like this whole really generation of this amazing artwork and everything that they have on there. And you guys have a fantastic display here
yes.
that shows so many different ones. And what makes them so unique is you can't make them anymore.
Not anymore. So anything, most of what you find now might be a reproduction. Unless, you know, you got lucky and found out like a leftover lot that never got used, because the metal lithographic plates that were used to print these labels were actually melted down for the war effort during World War II. So wood became in short supply, so crates couldn't even be constructed. And then the plates that were used for the lithographs were melted down. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, you know, it took a while after the war. I think it was about 1952 or so that the labels were no longer made, the crates were no longer constructed, and we switched to cardboard.
And that's what it still is today.
And that's what it still is today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, that's an amazing display. And then everything else that you guys have in your museum, it's, like you say, it's micro, but it's mighty. It's really, really nicely done.
And it's micro and it's mighty.
Oh, I did it. I did it. Oh, you should have seen the look that she just gave me. Woo! We'll not make that mistake again. Okay, micro and mighty. But,
yes.
So you're kind of a small little space right next to a large space.
Yeah.
And what's really cool is you were telling us about the history of all of this together. So I would love it if you could talk a little bit about that and basically how the museum got
started. So this land was actually donated to the city by Herman Zai. So this would have been an agricultural area. This probably would have been citrus. And instead, all of this land got donated to the city of Vero Beach, although at the time it was just the city of Vero. We added Beach because we thought more people would come here if we would do that.
And Florida and their marketing.
I know, Florida. Hey, we got the tourism thing down. And so this land was given to the city. And in 1935, in an effort to try to get folks back to work after the First World War, this amazing building, originally called the Community Building, was built between the federal government and the city government working together, and it was built in a whopping 3 months using Dade County pine, and the fireplace is coquina stone, so all naturally occurring materials from this area. And it was clamored for use. So the very first event that ever took place here, the city hadn't even figured out how are we going to rent the building out and how do we hand out keys and how do we recollect keys and who's managing all of this. That's how badly people wanted a community building.
Wow.
So the building was built in about 3 months, and literally the dedication hadn't even taken place yet, and the Indian River Garden Club hosted their 7th annual flower and garden show that eclipsed all previous flower shows.
Oh, yeah. This sounds, I would love to go. It sounds stunning.
Doesn't it, though? And so, you know, originally this was built truly for the community. And then during World War II, Vero Beach had a naval air station with 27,000 men and 900 women. Interesting ratios.
Be hard
there
to be those women.
Sitting ducks, I tell you, sitting ducks. And so this building then became the Servicemen Center, and where you and I are sitting now, the Indian River Citrus Museum, was added on in 1943, and this originally was a lounge for the servicemen. So the big community space was where the dances and boxing matches and concerts were taking place, and more quiet activities like reading, writing letters home, things like that would have taken place in this lounge.
And the museum is in the lounge now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we were walking around. It is a really big space, and it's really nice. And you kind of talked to us a little bit about, so there was a fire that happened. You can see scorch marks, and then you talked about the importance of the wood, the specific wood that was used.
Okay, so we have a sub-variety of this tree, longleaf pine, which occurs all over the eastern coastal plain. And so longleaf pine, the sub-variety is Dade County pine. It's extremely dense because of our humid conditions, because of the amount of rain that we have. And so this subspecies or sub-variety of plant becomes extremely valuable in the 30s and 40s for construction because it is somewhat fire resistant and somewhat insect resistant. Unfortunately, we over-harvested that wood.
As is the way.
And so you cannot find this in the wild any longer, but people do salvage it when they know of a building that might be being knocked down. It is in high demand to be salvaged and reused. In fact, there's a home not too far away from here that was being remodeled. They broke 3 hammers trying to nail into the Dade County pine.
Wow.
That is how dense it is. And that's what lends it those protective qualities.
That's got to be heavy, too.
It's very heavy.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that came into great use. The wood in there is so scorched that it's actually crackled. But you guys still use it. So what happened there?
Yeah. So I think it was in 1943 or 44. There was a big party here. It was called Shipwreck. The party had a theme. It was called Shipwrecked. And there was a band and there was dancing and they had brought in all these palm fronds and what have you. They borrowed a parrot to have at the party. And someone accidentally left the footlights turned on the stage. And, you know, back in the 40s, we didn't have fire retardant materials like we do today. The stage curtains eventually caught on fire. And at 3:15 a.m., a local taxi driver just happened to be driving down the street, saw the fire, reported it to the fire station, and the fire chief said, had that report been made 20 minutes later, the whole building, we would have lost the whole building.
Wow.
But that wood...
What timing?
Yeah, I know. But that wood had just enough resistance to allow the firemen to get here and put the fire out. Obviously, the building had to be closed down for several weeks. And a lot of what was in the lounge was lost due to smoke and, you know, just it wasn't worth saving, unfortunately. But the building was obviously worth saving. And they did save it.
And what's amazing is, I mean, it must be some really darn good wood because, like I said, it's crackled up there and it's still there.
And it still survived multiple hurricanes. And yes, in that condition.
Yeah, it's great.
Right. Yeah.
And so this building almost ended up not being.
Yeah. So in the late 60s, early 70s with, you know, urban renewal, some newer buildings were built. They're shiny and new and not a lot of character, in my opinion. But they're shiny and new, right? And so after World War II, this reverted back to a community center again. And this is where the city of Vero Beach housed its recreation department. And the black and white photos are hilarious. There were trapezes suspended from the ceiling. And it's too bad the listeners can't see this because there are seven huge beams in the room.
So if you would have been just a few feet off on your jump, you'd have nailed your head on these huge beams. They're only like 10 feet off the ground.
Right. I mean, they're high, but they're not that high. Not when you're talking about trampolines.
Yeah.
So this is where the city of Vero Beach housed its recreation department. And actually, this went from being the lounge to being the dance studio. So where you and I are now sitting, the Indian River Citrus Museum, was the dance studio as part of the recreation department. But with these new buildings having been built, activities dispersed to the new buildings, this building fell into disuse, thus disrepair, and the city was scheduled to knock the building down. In 1991, this building was on the city's demolition list. And a young woman, a local woman by the name of Millie Bunnell, led the charge, rallied the troops, rallied the community members to try to save the building, to get city council to change their mind. It was a very ugly public battle. There was some name calling, even, you know, that even got reported in the newspaper. But Millie didn't give up, and her, you know, her army of folk didn't give up, and they did successfully save the building. And after they saved the building, there was quite a bit of work that needed to be done, quite a bit of money that needed to be raised in order to do that work. They then created the nonprofit Vero Heritage Inc., who would then take over the restoration and stewardship of this building.
And that's how this came to be.
And then it was Millie's idea. Well, not only have we restored the building, but now we have this other little space. Let's turn it into the Indian River Citrus Museum, which has nothing to do with the historical building. But that's okay, Millie. We do love you.
And to be fair, I mean, it's a historical building. You might as well have some historical museum.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm with her.
Okay, yeah. Sometimes I feel a little torn between, you know, historical preservation and trying to support, you know, the operation of a micro and mighty museum.
Exactly. And you guys are completely nonprofit.
We are completely nonprofit. In fact, we don't even charge admission for the museum. We love, you know, donations, of course. We do go after grants. Some of them we really have to work hard for. And some of them are no-brainers. Like we do get a lovely grant from our local Tourist Development Council that helps to fund these activities. And actually, it's one of those grants that is allowing us to revamp and improve that label collection that you and I were checking out earlier.
So hopefully if anybody does come in, which you should, I highly recommend, then you will have this new section of your display.
Yes, so right now you only got to see about half of our label collection.
Oh, so you have quite a few.
Yeah. I think ultimately we have about 75 that are just from the Indian River Citrus District. For the entire state of Florida, someone has estimated that perhaps there were as many as 4,000 labels that had been used. They've become quite the collector's items. And it's one of our bigger draws in this small museum. You know, there is not a lot here. We pack a lot in. It's very juicy. But, people do come here with the intent of checking out the collection. And so we've been working to have them framed archivally. You know, some of them had faded over time and they were not framed in the best ways previously. And so we're rectifying all of that. They're all being framed museum quality archival frames, and we'll have movable walls. So instead of just two surfaces, there will actually be six surfaces on which all the labels will be exhibited.
Yeah. Well, and all of this is thanks to Millie and her crew.
Yeah.
And what's really crazy, which I honestly, like we were saying earlier, probably would never happen nowadays, but she actually got a letter.
She did.
An apology letter.
She got an amazing apology letter, and it's probably even a more favorite item of mine, even more so than the olive jar we've already discussed. Probably my favorite thing in the whole museum is the apology letter from the then retired city manager who really led the counterattack to, you know, he was promoting demolition of the building. Millie was trying to stop demolition of the building. So they were at loggerheads. And so he, in 1994, so 3 years after the building was saved and 1 year after the museum had been successfully installed, he wrote a lovely apology letter to Millie Bunnell. Yeah.
And basically was like, you were right and you were doing a fantastic job and thank God this happened.
He ate crow. He willingly ate crow.
Yeah, he
did. You know, he admitted that he was wrong and he apologized. Who in today's political climate would admit that they were wrong and apologize?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, yeah. Not many.
Not many. It's lovely. It's lovely. It's a great little reminder. You know, I know it's kind of trite. One person can make a difference, blah, blah, blah. Well, one person made a difference. Millie Bunnell made a big difference.
And because of that difference, the space is so publicly used. I mean,
so if it, you know, during healthy times, we would get about 5,000 guests into this Micro and Mighty Museum annually. That's a lot of people in this small space.
Yeah.
And I can't even estimate well over 50,000 people using the Heritage Center itself.
And you said they use it for all kinds of things. They use it for a quinceañera was here last weekend.
Yeah.
And bridal parties. Everything can be done.
You name it, it has happened here. We're a nonprofit, and so we like to give our local area nonprofits some love, and we offer lovely discounted rates for our local nonprofits. And so lots of other fundraisers are happening in that space, but private rentals as well. Maybe one of my most favorite weird kind of rentals, we had a college baseball team that was going from Nebraska, or was it Iowa, somewhere in the Midwest, was going to the Jackie Robinson training complex for an event, a training event. Somehow they found us and the family had a big family meal here and rented this out for a few hours on a weeknight as a nice big awesome space where they had a little cookout on the lawn and they had their dinner here. It was amazing. Yeah. How cool is that? Yeah.
So it's definitely a very used space.
Very used. You know, and now with the holidays upon us, we are rented for lots of holiday parties as well. And we will put up lots of decor in there. And you can see, even with the lights that are in there right now, it's so beautiful. And just imagine it, you know, the fireplace all decorated out. Yeah, it's lovely.
So you guys are a huge part of the community.
We are. We, you know, this was the original community building that is still building community. Yeah.
You guys and your adorable slogans.
I know. I know.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for teaching me all about citrus.
Thanks for having an interest. I know a lot of people come in here and they're like, what is this place going to be all about? And then they leave just as excited as I am. Yeah, so I love it.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you.